This is All In. I'm Matt Pilser. Farmers, researchers, industry, and advocates have lauded the 2018 Farm Bill, which relaxed regulations on the cultivation of hemp in the U.S. Since then, interest in hemp has skyrocketed. In ag-heavy states like Indiana, hundreds of farmers have come forward with interest and intent to grow the crop. Today, we're talking about what hemp production might mean for Indiana. We have a full suite of live panelists today, so let us know what you think of hemp on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and we'll get your questions and comments to our live panel today. Joining me in the studio now is Justin Swanson, president of the Midwest Hemp Council. Thanks for coming in, Justin.
Hey, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
And on the phone, we're joined by Marty Mahan, a farmer in Rush County, Indiana, and hemp chapter president of the Indiana Farmers Union. Thanks, Marty.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
We'll start with you, Marty. What are you growing over in Rush County?
Well, most of the farm is your typical row crops, corn and soybeans. But this year I had 9.5 acres of hemp grown for fiber and approximately 0.5 acre of it grown for cannabinoids or CBD.
So why'd you decide to grow hemp this year?
Well, this is my first opportunity. I've been advocating for the right for farmers to grow hemp since 2015, and this was our first opportunity to, and I was chomping at the bit.
So have you ever grown it before?
No, sir. I've tried several years ago with some friends down in Kentucky, but it was an unsuccessful experiment.
And so how's the experience been then, setting aside the whole process around it, just growing the hemp?
Well, all in all, it was a pretty good year, I feel like. Just like every other farmer and everyone else in agriculture, this spring was a challenge for us. But once we got the crops in the ground, which I was able to get everything in the ground that I had intended to, so once it was in the ground, it was a relatively good experience, I would say.
Was planting and growing it similar to other crops that you've grown before? Did it seem like a learning curve to getting it around?
Well, the fiber crop was very similar to traditional row crops, especially soybeans. That's what we planted it with. But the CBD part, that was something new to me, being more along the lines of vegetable or produce production.
And so you mentioned corn and soybeans. What else have you grown in the past?
Well, that's been the life of this farm, corn, soybeans, and wheat, you know, the pretty traditional Indiana row crops.
Justin, what is the Midwest Hemp Council?
So the Midwest Hemp Council, we were up to about close to 200 dues-paying members, and it's made up of farmers, processors, equipment manufacturers, laboratories, not just from Indiana, but really throughout the Midwest. And it's designed really to be a platform for people who want to do it right and want to really learn how to do, grow and process hemp the right way to kind of coalesce around. And it was really created because this isn't necessarily unique to the hemp industry, but in the hemp industry, the inaccurate information travels so much farther and so much faster than the accurate information. We just wanted to make sure, our farmers, people participating in the market, our regulators, policymakers really have the information needed to make an informed decision.
Can you explain what happened because of the 2018 U.S. Farm Bill in respect to hemp in Indiana?
So we Indiana actually had a hemp program on the books since 2015, and that was right after the 2014 Farm Bill passed. But there's just been a real reluctance, I think, to open this up to farmers to begin experimenting with again. And so our program kind of sat dormant for 4 years up until the passage of the 18 Farm Bill. From 2014 to 2018, I think we grew, right around 20 acres. And you compare that with this year, we licensed just over 5,300 acres. So the importance of the 18 Farm Bill was it finally gave, I think, Indiana the comfort to move forward, that, yes, hemp has been permanently removed from the Controlled Substances Act. The DEA has no longer any jurisdiction over hemp whatsoever. And really the intent here is to treat hemp just like any other agricultural commodity.
You talked about the bad news spreading or the misinformation, rather, spreading really fast. So this is your opportunity to explain what hemp is and how it's different from marijuana.
Sure. I typically use a dog example. It's the easiest way for me to explain it. Hemp and marijuana are both cannabis plants. They're both from the cannabis family. Just like a German Shepherd and a poodle are both dogs. People buy those dogs for different reasons. They have different traits. And so that's a similar thing with hemp and marijuana. From a legal standpoint, hemp is anything below 0.3% THC in it. So we're basically, from a legal standpoint, regulating the cannabis plant based off of the content of one cannabinoid out of, you know, upwards of 120.
And so you say the 0.3 threshold. Hemp is anything below 0.3, and then anything above that is marijuana. How much THC does marijuana typically have?
So if you – it's interesting because now we have regulated marijuana markets throughout the country. And typically those markets, you need 20-30% THC in your products.
We're talking about 0.3% versus 30%. That's a big difference.
It's a huge difference. And there's been a lot of talk in advocates wanting to raise that THC threshold up to a more workable number, like 1% THC. That's still not psychoactive, but it also gives the farmer a little more leeway to ensure that they have a compliant crop when they harvest.
So what can farmers do with hemp once they grow it?
So it depends on the variety you're growing. Like Marty said, you can grow the hemp for the CBD content of it. You can grow hemp for the grain or the seed of it, and you can grow it for the fiber. So when you grow it for fiber, it's really cool because you look back at the World War II efforts for the Hemp for Victory, which USDA was encouraging our farmers to grow for the war effort. These plants get up to 10, 14 feet tall. So it's really cool to see. When you grow hemp for CBD, that's kind of a shorter, fatter plant, and it kind of looks more similar to marijuana. And that's, I think, really it's been our biggest obstacle is trying to decouple hemp and marijuana. They did it at the federal level. We've done it at the state level, but now it's just more of this education campaign we need to maintain.
What's unique about growing it from the farmer's perspective?
So I think it goes back to the misinformation. Over the years, I've heard people say, you could throw hemp seeds on rocks and, you'll become a millionaire overnight kind of thing. I think the number one thing that farmers in particular underestimate is the labor required for growing hemp. In particular for the CBD, it's just very, very labor intensive. You need about 3 people per acre for 3 weeks straight going out there and checking for male plants and male parts on a female plant to ensure that your crop doesn't pollinate. Because once it pollinates, your crop's no longer any good because it's seeded.
Mm. Marty, are you excited about hemp right now, or is it more cautious optimism since we're still in the early stages?
Yeah, cautious optimism is a very good term for it. I think there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of potential here, but until we finish this harvest season and are able to run the numbers and see, just how legitimate those opportunities are.
What did you have to do to get approval to grow hemp this season?
Well, I worked with Jamie Petty Kimball, who is also the treasurer of the Midwest Hemp Council, and we put together a research project with Purdue University and several other farmers in the state to track some of this information so that we can share the information with other farmers and help them to have more accurate information moving forward.
Are you going to make money off of your hemp?
Well, that's yet to be seen. I do not have a buyer for any of it as of just yet, and that's okay. Making money wasn't my goal this year. It really was to learn as much as I could, especially on this CBD material and how that process just really works. So,
do you think any other farmers will be able to make money from it this year, or is it too difficult to profit with the restrictions in place?
I think there will be some farmers that will profit this year, especially those that are already in that produce world where they were used to the amount of labor and equipment that's taken for those kind of crops. I think they were positioned to make some money this year. I think by and large, most people should at least break even, I think.
How do you find out the answers to some of the questions that come up when you're growing something that's brand new to you?
Well, the first thing is asking a lot of questions. You know, I've spent, as I said, I've been advocating since 2015, and I've spent a lot of time back and forth between here and Kentucky to learn as much as I could, and I use those resources as much as I can. I'm not afraid to pick up the phone and ask questions when I'm not sure. And because of the amount of time that I've put into it, I try to make myself available to answer the phone when folks call me as well. So.
What are your goals for next season, Marty? Do you think that you want to grow hemp again?
Absolutely, I will. And again, until we get through the harvest season here and get the numbers crunched, I'm having a hard time deciding exactly what I'm going to do. I will do fiber and CBD again next year. It's just a matter of deciding how much.
Do you have estimates on how much profit you might make compared to how much you've made on past row crops that you've put in? I imagine seeing numbers like that might help convince farmers to at least try it out if they're nervous about it.
There are. And, you know, everything that I've seen so far is pretty much anecdotal evidence, and I've heard astronomical numbers and all the way down to some realistic things, and I hesitate to put any kind of number to it myself. I'm not comfortable with that.
We got about a minute left. Justin, back to the educational piece. Do you think that there's enough support for farmers growing this new plant just to kind of learn more about it?
Well, I think right now the existing support system, as Marty mentioned, it's really farmer to farmer, processor to farmer, retailer to farmer. You know, this is really an industry that's kind of started at the grassroots level. And, you know, we're only going to be successful because, as Marty said, this is really about making sure everyone's operating the best, most efficient way possible, ensuring that they're putting products out on the market that are safe and consumers are asking for.
We're talking today about hemp production in Indiana with Marty Mahan. He's the farmer in Rush. He's a farmer in Rush County and a hemp chapter president of the Indiana Farmers Union. Marty, thank you so much for joining us this segment.
Yes, thank you.
Justin Swanson is president of the Midwest Hemp Council. He's going to stick around for the next segment. And up next, we'll talk more about the hemp industry in Indiana, and we'll bring in a new voice to learn about how Indiana is handling it differently than other states. As always, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. Are you excited about hemp being grown in Indiana? How do you think it should be regulated? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on the hemp industry in Indiana, I want to tell you about our last show. Yesterday, we spent the hour with Mark Merriman. He's the author of the Haunted Indiana book series, as well as several other books on Indiana ghost stories and folklore. With Halloween just a week away, you can find that show wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In. Today, we're talking about hemp. Industrial hemp was legalized just a year and a half ago under the 2018 U.S. Farm Bill. Some Indiana farmers are trying it out, and rules and regulations for the industry are being created while they do it. As always, we'd love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. In the studio, we're joined again by Justin Swanson, president of the Midwest Hemp Council. And we also have Marguerite Holt, hemp production specialist at Purdue Extension. Thanks for joining us, Marguerite.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Marguerite Bolt, my apologies. Marguerite,
yeah, that's okay.
you're a hemp production specialist at Purdue Extension. That's a new position, I understand. What do you do in that role?
So the position was primarily created because the university saw that they needed to take an active role in the industry. And so they created the position for me to sort of be a connector to help growers connect to researchers and extension educators, as well as people in the hemp industry. So they kind of wanted me to serve almost as a liaison, and they needed someone to provide fact-based evidence about hemp production because the internet can be a dark hole of misinformation. So they wanted someone to try to put out some good, reliable information as we learn more about hemp production in Indiana.
So just how busy have you been?
I've been extremely busy. It's been a very, very busy 4 months for me.
This is a brand new industry in Indiana. Is it a challenge getting all of the different people working together? Or does it help that Indiana is such an agricultural state that you kind of slot this new thing into the systems that already exist?
It helps that there's a lot of communication between our farmers. We, like you said, are a strong agricultural state, so that is extremely helpful. But everyone is navigating this new industry, so there are lots of challenges that we face every day.
You've done research work on hemp. What do you think of the crop in general? How valuable could it be to farmers in a place like Indiana?
Well, I think that the fact that there are so many different end uses for hemp can make it extremely valuable. I think a lot of farmers see this as another rotational option. Some growers are seeing this as a way to, you know, help increase profits. I personally think it's a very interesting plant to work with. It's fascinating to research, especially since we've had such a long gap in production. And because Indiana historically grew hemp and we have these wild populations of hemp in our landscape, it makes this a very fascinating crop to sort of bring back to Indiana.
What about the larger conversations around hemp? How have you seen that change over the years?
I think I've seen, in general, just from when I started at Purdue in 2017, I've seen a lot more acceptance just from a research standpoint of people being a little apprehensive about hemp research to, you know, supporting it. And now there's federal funding available for hemp research. And, you know, a lot of people have become much more interested in the state of Indiana. And so we've sort of seen that conversation shift from, you know, confusion and misinformation to excitement and, you know, the prospect of a new crop.
Yeah, there's a lot that we need to learn about as we sort of bring it back into the landscape. How important is it for farmers and researchers to have a close relationship? You got to have somebody to grow it, right?
Yeah, it's incredibly important. You know, there's only so much we can do on our research farms. So having growers all across Indiana produce hemp provides us with a ton of valuable information. And so we really rely on our farmers to give us information about hemp production.
Justin, we've heard about issues with the testing process. Can you explain that? The plants are tested for their THC levels primarily, right?
Yeah, and so this is every state kind of is doing their own thing on how to actually take the testing sample. So there's basically two issues right now for if you're a farmer trying to get this out of the ground. One is the sample size of the plant they take. The very top part of the plant, that the top flower cola, that's the highest concentration of cannabinoids in the plant. And also, obviously, where all the THC content is going to be as well. And right now, Indiana is taking the top 2 inches of the plant and saying that's a representative sample of what the farmer's selling. And that's really jeopardizing some of our farmers just because it's not a true representative sample of the plant. And the other thing also is this discussion between Delta-9 THC, which is the psychoactive component, and THCA. THCA is the precursor. It's the acid form of THC. And so when you heat THCA, it converts to THC. And that's when you're consuming marijuana or you're heating it or when you're putting it in food, you have to heat it to activate that THCA in there. So in a sense, we're almost, again, putting our farmers in a really difficult position to be a half-compliant crop when you're adding, based on the testing protocol, the sample size and the machine you're using and the formula you're using to add that what THC content actually is in that plant.
And if they're growing it for fiber and you've got a really healthy crop, but you take that sample from the flower and it comes back instead of 0.3%. And again, marijuana is closer to 25-30%. If it comes back 0.4, you lose your whole fiber crop.
Yeah. And that's a huge concern for, you know, the entire industry, because if the farmers aren't successful, this whole industry is not going to go anywhere. You know, and you have, again, a 12-14 foot fiber plant and you're taking the top 2 inches of a flower that you're not even selling, because on that fiber, you're selling the stalk, that 12-foot stalk, right? The flower to you is useless. So we're really trying to work with our regulators and other policymakers to help educate them on, you know, let's give our farmers the opportunity to be successful. They've taken enough risks as it is. And I think we need to really make sure our regulations in Indiana make sense. If you look at other states, Kentucky does 7 inches, Oregon does 8 inches. So it's really just we need to start cherry picking from across the country on best practices here.
Do you have an example of a state that you think is doing it right?
Yeah, I mean, so Tennessee is what we call it, referred to as a Delta 9 state. They follow the federal law and their state law. There's no mention of adding THCA, your THCA content into your THC content. Kentucky does, takes a sample from the top, middle, and bottom part of the plant. So you can really, again, just cherry pick on these states who are doing it right. If you ask me, is any state doing it absolutely right? No, but that's the beauty of kind of playing catch up here, is we can see some of the mistakes and some of the successes other states have had and try to weave them into our state here in Indiana.
Do you think it's because of a lack of resources that we don't have a more specific rule or regulation behind it, meaning, hey, this is what the federal government says, so this is what we're going to do, and we don't have enough people to argue about it?
That certainly could be part of it. The other part, again, is just pure education. We need to make sure that when we talk to these regulators, and our regulators get it, this isn't marijuana. But in the back of the mind of some law enforcement agencies, prosecutors, I mean, that's back of the mind is, well, if you guys let hemp being grown, marijuana is coming around the corner. And that's just, that's just not true.
Yeah, a lot of players at the table. Yep. Marguerite, let's talk about Indiana's approach to this. That it would put a cap on how many farmers could grow hemp this season. Who made that decision?
That was largely made by the Office of the Indiana State Chemist.
What was the thinking behind putting these limitations in? What advantages are there in having a smaller group?
I think one of the main advantages is just fostering communication. You know, it's really difficult to communicate with thousands of growers opposed to 100 growers. And so this way, we're able to monitor growers throughout the season and see what is working and what isn't working, and then just develop that communication network.
We've heard about what other states have done a little bit from Justin. I assume we could learn a lot by watching them. Is there any kind of organized effort to learn from this?
Yeah, I definitely think we're learning from within the state and outside of the state. I communicate with lots of collaborators around the country that their states are running their industry a little bit differently. And then we're also going to get a lot of information from the reports that growers will submit at the end of the season that we'll make publicly available. So we're working very hard to learn as much as we can about not only Indiana growers, but also some of these other states that are nearby and doing it a little bit differently.
Are there some specific things that you hope to learn from the process in Indiana? Lessons learned that people are wondering about?
Yeah, I'm really interested in looking just at agronomics. So how do we grow this crop in the best way for Indiana in our specific system? How do our growers fit this into their rotational models? I'm an entomologist, so I'm very interested in insects that feed on the plant. So I'm, very curious to see what kind of pests become more prevalent as we see increased production. We've gotten a pretty good idea of some of the issues we're going to see next year just by having growers across the state of Indiana. And even though it's a small amount, that's incredibly helpful to see production in different areas of the state.
And this might be a whole other conversation, but I mean, does hemp tend to hold up against various common pesticides? Or do we even know yet?
So we can't use any pesticides on hemp. That's not allowed in our state. Some states have released a list of allowable products, mostly organic or what we call minimum risk pesticides. We don't have much of a list in the state of Indiana. They're working through that. So we don't have those tools like we do for corn and beans and some of our other crops.
But as I understand it, it's a pretty robust plant. Does it hold its own against pests? Does it tend to?
Okay, so is it pest resistant? That's probably one of the biggest misconceptions about hemp. It actually is fed upon by lots of different insects. Many of them are pests that we see in our agricultural landscape. One of the most prevalent pests this year across the country was corn earworm, which it can be pretty devastating to sweet corn and field corn, but it is really attracted to hemp plants, and it feeds on the flower material, which if you're growing for CBD production, that's the marketable portion of the plant, and it actually can cause a lot of destruction. And this is a pest that it not only feeds on corn, but it feeds on tomatoes and lots of other plants all around the Midwest. in the southern U.S. So there are lots of pests that are switching from other crops into hemp. It's not a, you know, a pest-free crop like the internet says it is.
So then how important is it for the regulations to be relaxed so that pesticides can be used on hemp, do you think?
Well, I think it's really important to investigate some pesticide options, but, you know, we're also a little apprehensive about just opening the floodgates and saying we're going to make special exemptions for lots of different pesticides in hemp because, you know, for CBD production, this is a product that's being consumed. It's either being smoked or it's being ingested, and we want to make sure that consumers are safe. So it's more than just trying to reduce pests. There's a very important human health concern that we have to consider. So we're being very, very cautious when we're looking at pesticide options in hemp.
Speaking of floodgates, Justin, what about you? Do you like how Indiana chose to go about bringing hemp into the picture, starting out small instead of just opening it up to everybody?
I think, look, there's different ways to go about it. We are where we are. To Marguerite's point, it is easier to work with people. But at the same time, you know, you have farmers knocking down the door to figure out how to reintegrate this back into their family farm. And I think it's past time to allow them, give them the opportunity to do so. We have a, you know, our statutes, both research and commercial. I think it's time for the 2020 session to let these farmers grow up for commercial purposes, you know, not having to team up with a institution of higher education to grow it. You know, Kentucky hasn't done that since the beginning, and I'd like to see us, again, open this up a little bit more, get the government out of the way a little bit more, and just allow the farmers to do what they do best, and that's figure out how to grow this stuff again.
Are there a lot of farmers around the state who are itching to grow hemp right now who maybe weren't able to or aren't able to? What sense do you have about how many might be interested?
It's hard to say, but right now I think we have, you know, a little under 200 people licensed to grow, either indoor or outdoor. You know, I see that number doubling or tripling next year, and, you know, we probably have close to, you know, 10,000 or so acres licensed for next year. But that's just dependent on what the state decides to do with our regulations for the 2020 growing season.
We've talked a little bit about some of the rules and regulations, but let's try to get a comprehensive overview right now on what rules are in place in the hemp industry.
So we have zero.
There are none?
There are none.
I mean, whatsoever.
Whatsoever.
2018 Farm Bill came in. I mean, you got to stay below the 0.3.
Yep. So we have statute. We have laws, mm-hmm. right? The bill we passed a couple years ago based on the 14 Farm Bill actually required the seed commissioner to develop rules to implement the program, and we still don't have any rules in the books. And that's why the industry is very, very excited and also a little apprehensive of – once these rules do get released, hopefully in the next couple weeks, on what those look like to ensure that they're farmer-friendly but also are designed in a way to maintain the integrity of the hemp market.
Randolph on Facebook says, hemp should only be regulated to the extent that corn, soybeans, and wheat are. What do you think, Justin?
So this is a common misconception. This is still a very highly regulated plant. Right, at both the federal and the state levels. So there may be a time when that's not true, but right now it's, I mean, you still need a license and you do have to submit certain information, pass a background check. You know, you can't have had a criminal drug conviction within the last 10 years. It's still a very regulated market. It's a regulated plant. So I think we're a ways off of this just, you know, buying seeds online and planting and not telling anyone about it.
Do you think it's overregulated based on what you know?
You do need sensible regulations. I mean, cross-pollination is going to be an absolutely huge issue. It was this year. It's going to continue to be next year. There's no good answer on how to do that. And you know, depending on setback requirements, it depends on who you ask. Some say 8 miles. Others say 25 miles. But again, this is why it's so important for farmers to communicate. That way they know what their neighbor's doing. Because if you have two CBD grows next to each other or a fiber and a CBD grow next to each other, that can complicate things very quickly.
Mm. Who's writing new regulations for hemp in Indiana?
So in the bill that the General Assembly passed during the 2019 session was Senate Rolled Act 516. And in that bill, it set up what's called the Indiana Hemp Advisory Committee. We don't have rulemaking authority, but it is designed to provide guidance and feedback to the seed commissioner in the development of those rules. So on this committee, Midwest Hemp Council has a seat, state police, USDA, we have a seed dealer, We have a farmer, Mark Boyer, who's really kind of the pioneer in Indiana. He was the first one to really kick down the bureaucratic door and grow 14 acres last year. So it's really a combination of stakeholders and the general public are welcome to attend these as well. And the intent behind creating this committee was to make sure that we're cherry picking best practices from other states, and we're again setting our farmers up for success and not necessarily failure based on those regulations.
And how will the USDA guidelines, which I guess are expected to come out sometime in the next couple of weeks, how will they have an impact on how things work here in Indiana?
So we have a pretty good a general idea of what's going to be in those. The 2018 Farm Bill sets out kind of USDA is basically going to set out a floor for, hey, states, here are the bare minimum requirements you have to have in your state plan for us to approve it. Some states have bills that they passed that said we're not going to start until those USDA regulations are passed. So they're going to actually probably be at a disadvantage if USDA delays any longer. Because keep in mind, doing this stuff and planning to grow hemp takes time. You have to secure quality genetics. You have to secure the land, do soil sampling. So it's not a overnight thing. This is a months-long process to do it right.
Lots to talk about today, and we'll be back with both of our guests in this final segment, Justin Swanson, president of the Midwest Hemp Council, and Marguerite Bolt, hemp production specialist at Purdue Extension. And up next, we'll talk more about the laws, rules, and regulations around hemp production and the hemp industry, what's being worked on now, and what might be coming in the next couple weeks. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on the hemp industry in Indiana. We're joined again by Justin Swanson, president of the Midwest Hemp Council, and Marguerite Bolt, hemp production specialist at Purdue Extension. Marguerite, you mentioned a common misconception about hemp earlier. What are other misconceptions out there right now?
I think one of the biggest ones is that hemp is a crop you can just throw seeds in the ground and grow. You know, part of this is in Indiana, especially, is we have these wild populations of hemp called ditchweed that pop up and they seem to do pretty well. So people think, oh, well, that grows. Why can't I just throw it in the ground and I don't need to manage it and, you know, I can walk away? And that is just not true. We found that to not be true the last several years by doing research at our research farms. But then this year, growers found that to be true as well. It's just there are some nuances to producing this crop, and there are definitely challenges that we're figuring it out.
So these are wild populations, and they're here because hemp was historically grown in Indiana, right? Or is it a native plant?
It was because it was historically grown in Indiana. Hemp is not native to the United States.
Where is it native to? Just out of curiosity.
They think it originated in Asia, kind of in the Tibetan Plateau area. That's where they think cannabis sativa originated in, and then moved westward as humans moved the plant, where they used it for fiber and seed production.
Justin, is there a certain thing you hear from Indiana farmers who are nervous about getting into hemp maybe more than anything else?
Like a particular topic?
Yeah. What are they nervous about?
Well, I think it was kind of a rude awakening for a lot of them. This isn't a commodity yet, meaning you can't just grow it and then expect someone to come up to your door and buy it from you. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we've been really harping on people is we still have a pretty immature supply chain, no matter what your outlet is. So, you know, we've been encouraging farmers to make sure you have a contract in your hand before you plant anything, and that way you know exactly what you're doing with the either the biomass, the seed, or the fiber before you plant it.
Mm. Let's get to the State House. You've done some lobbying work on this issue. How would you characterize Indiana lawmakers' feelings on hemp right now?
I think it's night and day over the past 4 or 5 years. They're more and more educated. We've actually had a ton of turnover as well over the past couple years. So you're getting some younger people in there who, you know, didn't necessarily grow up on this war on drugs where you had, you know, where hemp was misaligned with marijuana for the past 75 years at the federal level. And I think a lot of them understand. I mean, the average farmer today in Indiana is about 55 and a half years old. This is a really a way for the next generation of farming families these young farmers can take ownership over this new crop. Everyone's basically starting out at the same level of knowledge, and it's really dependent on how much you're willing to learn and how much work you're willing to put in to really set yourself apart from the rest of the market.
How have you seen politics in Indiana have an impact on this issue, especially compared to how it's gone in other states?
So we, you know, it may seem astonishing to some, but we're actually a lot farther ahead than most states. You know, we obviously Kentucky's out there, Colorado's out there, Oregon's out there, but in terms of the Midwest, it's us in Kentucky, and we're doing a great. Indiana's doing a great job with support from Purdue University, in particular the Extension Office. If you had asked me 2 years ago, would Purdue hire someone like Marguerite to spend full time on hemp, I would have said absolutely no way. So I think it's a slow evolution, and I think the more and more people understand the profit margins in here, depending on what you're growing for, and the more lawmakers hear from the farmers, I just think the better.
Let's broaden the question and get away from lawmakers. What about the culture in Indiana outside the state house? Has that changed in any way since you've started working on this to kind of make it easier or harder to get people on board?
I think it's a lot easier. Again, the more and more – I mean, obviously CBD is the rock star of the industry right now. That's where a ton of the money is being invested in, and that's where – I mean, even my grandma's takes CBD, and she is, you know, stopped taking three medications that she said she doesn't need anymore for pain, which is great to hear. So it's really I think CBD is doing a great job of opening people's eyes to what this is. And I think that's kind of the start of the rabbit hole for a lot of people where they start diving in. And they say, oh, wow, this was actually grown back in the World War II era here in Indiana. I just think that, again, the more and more people educate themselves on the issue, it's harder and harder to be against it.
Marguerite, do you think Indiana might set itself apart in more ways than they already have with the regulations that will be created here?
I'm not sure about that. I think what Indiana is really going to set itself apart compared to our other states is our ability to produce high-quality crops. I have a lot of faith in Indiana growers to produce this crop well, and I think that we're going to see that in the coming years. We're Indiana's, I think, going to be a force to be reckoned with.
Justin, can you tell me about the conference coming up?
Great. Yeah, thank you. We have a Hemp at the Crossroads. If you go to hempatthecrossroads.com, it's November 16th and November 17th. We'll have ISDA there. We'll have the Seed Commissioner. We'll have other market participants from all around the Midwest coming in. And this is going to be an annual conference where it's kind of a lessons learned. The first day is going to be more focused on the farmers, and the second day is going to be more focused on policy and rules, regulations, you know, how do farmers protect themselves via contracts. So it's going to be a great opportunity for people to get together and coalesce around the platform and share best practices.
Lots to learn there. Marguerite, one last question. Got about 30 seconds. Do you want researchers to keep working with farmers past this initial phase? What might that look like?
Oh, yeah. I definitely think that's going to be really important to see this industry advance. We need to keep working with growers. We need to do research at Purdue and at other research institutes. And I think we're going to try to do that as much as possible.
Marguerite Bolt, hemp production specialist at Purdue Extension, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Justin Swanson, president of the Midwest Hemp Council, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We'll close out the show today with a recent conversation I had with Don Robison from the Office of Indiana State Chemist. So what is the Office of Indiana State Chemist?
Office of Indiana State Chemist, or we call it OISC, O-I-S-C, is the agricultural regulator for feed, seed, fertilizer, pesticides, and hemp in Indiana.
And so what do you do in your role as a seed administrator?
Much of my role before the Farm Bill passed and hemp took over my world was running the Indiana State Seed Lab based here on Purdue campus. We test seed to make sure that people are getting what is advertised and what they are paying for.
Now, when you say hemp took over your world, what do you mean by that?
Well, on December 20th, 2018, the Farm Bill was signed, and very soon after that, my email and phone calls blew up. And when I say blew up, I mean, well, here's a number. Since December 20th, my assistant and I have had over 13,000 hemp emails. That's two people.
Wow.
The demand for knowledge, the desire to find out more about this crop, far exceeds any other crop we grow in Indiana. We had to get headsets because the number of phone calls we were getting, just not the same as number of emails, but the number of phone calls we were getting far exceeded what we were used to. We were used to, you know, 10 phone calls a day. How to grow it, what they need to know to grow it, whether they are eligible to be licensed, how to go about that. Are we accepting licenses? Do they have to own the ground or can they rent the ground? Who could be a source of seed or plants for them? You know, those type of questions are just over and over. So we've got a frequently asked questions that now has 52 questions on it.
that's a lot. Have you had to add staff? I mean, my gosh, 13,000 emails.
We have not added staff. We have utilized more staff in the agency. So in the state chemist office, we've utilized more staff than what we normally do. The website is much more robust than what it was before. We have 9 different sections of the website just on hemp. Before the Farm Bill was signed, we had one section that had probably 3 links about hemp.
Wow. And there was a cap on growers this year. Why was that?
Well, we put a cap on outdoor growers at 100. The reason for that was it was quickly getting to the point where it was more than we could manage. You know, we talked earlier about the number of emails. A couple of reasons for that. All of this research proposals, all of this research work comes unfunded for the state chemist office. So you asked about whether we hired new people. We don't have the funding to hire new people until the crop is commercial, which we hope will happen in 2020. So when it's commercial, we are required by law or charged in the law to collect fees enough to cover our costs. This year, this was all done at no charge. Eventually, farmers and growers and processors and truck drivers and handlers will pay a fee to be licensed. But this year, nobody paid any fees to be licensed.
And you license for more than just farmers, right? Who else needs a license in the industry?
University researchers, and we quickly outstripped the amount of true university PhD professors that were willing to get involved in this with no funding. you know, professors like to have grants to work from and things like that if they're going to put a lot of extra time into something. So without any funding, what we did is we were able to work out a deal, a pretty sweet deal for the Indiana farmer and the hemp industry, with the Purdue University Extension educators. And those are people that are the agricultural natural resources educators. Very few of them are actual PhDs, but they're used to working in research all the time with local farmers. They're used to helping problem solve and troubleshoot issues on a farm. So we were able to add dozens of agricultural natural resources extension educators to the researcher group and help more people get licensed.
And you have a role in the testing process as well, where inspection crews pull samples to check THC levels. What have the conversations about that been like between growers and inspectors? Has there been any frustration with the process?
There has been some frustration. Everybody has been very easy to work with. Let me just say that first. You know, when we try to get a hold of someone and we can't get a hold of them and we're supposed to be testing a crop within a certain time period because an inspector is in a certain part of the state, that provides some potential frustrations for our inspector's standpoint. When we test the crop, there's always that trepidation on the farmer's part because this is still a crop. You know, you remember, if it goes over 0.3, it's marijuana, according to federal law. So there's always trepidation on the farmer's part or the grower, indoor grower, that says, man, I want to know how you're testing. I want to know how you're doing everything. Are you doing it the same way as my cousin's getting it done in Kentucky or my uncle's getting it done in Illinois? And right now there's 50 states and there's several different ways that this is being done. So I don't know if I would necessarily call it frustration as much as I would just questioning. They want to know how we're doing everything. We are doing our testing the same way that the DEA approved our testing back in 2014. What's changed this year is there are so many more people involved in it. And for the first time on any large scale, we're testing actual farmers' property. you know, rather than Purdue University or Vincennes University property or Indiana University property, with a professor who doesn't want the crop to go hot because he's going to lose some of his research. But this time, we're testing farmers' fields that if the crop goes hot, they could lose money. That's a very different feeling when you're testing a farmer's crop that might lose money.
And the rules and regulations around hemp are being written right now, as you say, and your office is working on that. So what's the approach going into those rules? What impact do you hope to have on the industry here?
Well, a couple of things. In Indiana, our specific rules, we have a process in Indiana where the Indiana Hemp Advisory Committee, and we've been floating ideas that will go into rule with that committee for the last few months. That committee was set up in statute. So there are roughly 14, 15 people, I think, on that committee. And so we've been floating the ideas, you know, what type of fee should we charge? We've done the internal studies of what it's going to cost us, but we also try very hard to be easy to work with where we can. And if what it's going to cost us is going to be more than the average person wants to get involved in this could possibly pay, well, that's not going to do anybody good. So we've been floating, you know, it'll probably cost in this range. How's that sound? It'll probably put a limit on number of acres, put a limit on whether it's near a church and a school because of the smell. The crop, as it gets closer to harvest, definitely has a, I wouldn't call it a fragrance. It's definitely an odor. So we're floating those kind of ideas. At the same time, we can't finalize anything because the USDA puts down their own set of rules, and their rules trump our rules. So we're hoping to hear from the USDA that they have a standard testing protocol that all states will follow, because many states are following the same protocol we are, but not all of them are. So that provides that rub where somebody says, I've got a cousin in this state, and they're not testing that way. Well, don't know what to tell you. We're testing the way the DEA approved.
Yeah, well, let's talk about those farmers and what they have to say. Have you heard from them about the rules and regulations that they are hoping for?
Well, we actually have a hemp grain farmer on the hemp advisory committee. So we hear his opinions, and he actually talks to a lot of other farmers. So we get the unfiltered opinion there, and then we get farmers calling in to our office on a regular basis. So I think we've heard what the farmer says. We've also heard what the small farmer says. You know, the average person that calls us is actually what I would call a professional farmer. You know, they're farming hundreds of acres or more, and they're looking for a crop rotation process here. You know, they're looking for something that they can grow and make more money than they can right now on corn and beans, get involved in a new industry, maybe because of the CBD craze, those type of things. But we've also heard from the small farmer who farms 3 to 5 acres or has a 3,000 square foot greenhouse that they've been growing bedding plants or flowers in. We're trying to make sure that the rules and regulations don't eliminate their opportunity in this new industry as well. The reality is there will be a minimum number of square feet for indoor, and there will be a minimum number of acres for outdoor, because the law is going to make this a commercial crop, and we're not going to allow, an example that Dr. Waltz, the state chemist, uses, we're not going to allow 6 plants in somebody's backyard and call that a commercial crop.
Don Robinson, he's the administrator at the Office of Indiana State Chemist, a busy man as well. Don, thanks for your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And correction, that's Don Robinson. My apologies. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross, who also composed this theme music. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get podcasts. Join us tomorrow for the Friday Pitch-In, where we catch up on some of the biggest Indiana headlines of the week. And we'll also find out more about the 2019 Indiana Manufacturing Survey with Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Samantha Horton. And Ball State Economics professor Steve Horwitz joins us to share why Halloween spending means economic prosperity. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. We're back tomorrow at 1 for that conversation. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.